Can you hear me? Yeah, I was just about to move this. What? It's just water. It's just water. If it is there, it's just water. Closer to you or closer to them? Closer where? What should the epicenter be? I was going to say, what should the epicenter be? So I'm going to make an exception on my use of the word cool. How cool is it that two people from our congregation go out west and they get to feel an earthquake in the middle of the night? Right there. Oh, right there. It's only me. I need a little help. There. Perfect. Who didn't know? Oh, you didn't know? Oh, sorry. They're fine. They liked it. They didn't get hurt. The house didn't fall down on them. Sorry, I wouldn't have said it if I didn't know you knew. 5.8, right? 2 days ago, 3 days ago? Jerusha didn't know? Oh, my apologies. I wouldn't have said anything if I thought people didn't know. Nobody was hurt. Nothing fell apart. No cars fell into the earth. There was no company of Korah to get swallowed or nothing. Enjoyable shaking. One of my relatives complained that there was an earthquake and she didn't get to feel it. So, what? Yeah. So, anyway, I had no idea the family didn't know. I guess I thought it was. No, I didn't hear it directly. I just found out from some, through the grapevine, through a branch that had not been pruned from the vine for the good of the vine. I heard. Okay, so I have a lot of thoughts in my head. Just a few moments ago, I was remembering, once in a while it crosses my mind, but I think I may have been in Rochester. It's a long time ago. Long time ago. Yeah. It was probably the first time I ever encountered Mike Bickle. And he spoke there, and the only thing I actually remember from that particular message was he was describing Yeshua at the right hand of the Father. By the way, do you think he gets off like the chair or whatever and walks around some of the time, or do they just sit there all the time in a couple fancy chairs? And I'll throw this one question in, just how many of you think that the Father shaves now and then? What? Shaves, yeah. Think he has a beard? Does he have a beard? If he does, what color is it? Oh yeah, well, we probably do know, actually, but I don't want to get off too far on that. Okay, so Mike Bickle gives his description of Yeshua with respect to a particular thing, right? And that is his wanting the wedding to happen, right? Which means that the kingdom comes in fullness, and he finally gets to, really get married, I mean, can you imagine a 2,000-year longer, maybe, engagement? This is quite a while. I mean, there's patience, and then there's a patience on steroid, and then there's falling asleep and forgetting anything was even supposed to happen ever. And then there's saying, ever since the fathers slept, they they've been talking about this, and not going to happen. That's the range of things, you know. People say in one place, God made promises, you know. Abraham died, Isaac died, Jacob died, his kids all died, Joseph's dead. Come on, can we give up on that now and just, you know, create a just society where I'm rich and I have steak every night and where I can do what I want and nobody's going to bother me and things don't rust and just forget about God's not coming. He fell asleep. He's gone. He left the scene a long time ago. And the guy who I'm named after says, I was almost said the guy is named after me. He says, make no mistake. God is not slow about his promise, right? But does it seem slow? I've known people that long so much for the kingdom to come and long so much for the congregation they're in to become what they conceive of as the way it should all be. I'm thinking of an individual now that I've known for many, many, many years. And it's interesting because over the time that I've known that person, I think I've watched their longing and their perceptions, and they're kind of, they've been very faithful where they are, but there's been like a lot of complaint over the many years. And I think I've watched it turn into something more like an abiding appreciation of redemption and the fact that these people gathered together, worship God, and I don't think this is the Lord of the Flies, but it is a distraction. And it may very well, you know, I saw a thing about how they're trying to turn locusts into bomb-sniffing drones. Very interesting. And they've figured out how to teach them to smell the explosive they want them to smell. That was the easiest part, and they showed how they do it. And very interesting. But then they need a little, basically, it's like a little tiny computer on them and a transmitter and that gets the information, which apparently is actually wired into the locust teeny tiny little brain. And this they've done. They've already done this. They know how to do it. They need to make the batteries smaller. There's some challenges, but apparently that part they're not too worried about, that they're going to do it. Anyway, then they have to figure out, well, how are we going to get the locusts to go where we want them to? That's a pretty good, obvious question, right? I mean, if the locust is going to go and sniff where you don't want to send people because you don't want to get them blown up, you got to get the locust to like either want to go there and go there or somehow take command of its navigational system. And they figured out that some little bit of gold something or other on the tip of the wings that they can control how light reaches them, and that actually will make them fly where they want them to go. I can't explain it real well, but it's pretty amazing. And they're planning on sending, like, you know, swarms of locusts into these places to sniff out the stuff they want to find so that they can take care of it without sending people in to get blown up. What? I could find them, but I don't have them now. But they were talking. Look, I tell you, this is all very valid over here somewhere. No, I'm going to get a sore neck, and you're going to be looking in my ear. Now look, almost all of the scientists involved in this are Indian. That's one verification that this is true, and that it's going to succeed. But I'd have to look up the stuff. It's very interesting. So, now somebody remind me how that related to what I was talking about. It did, but I forgot. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Exactly. See, the thing is, I think that the enemy can send the fly to bother you. Now, the thing is, the fly can only actually bother you so much. In truth, the fly can only bother you so much. It doesn't actually have the power to make you angry. It doesn't have the power to rob you of your thought process, but you can give the fly that. And some people have much more trouble than others. Now, when I was a little kid, I probably had more trouble at one point. Simply, like, I would allow sometimes a mosquito to bite me somewhere on my face, which I really don't like. But see, for the purpose of being able to get the shot with my bow at the deer that I wanted, I would endure certain things. I would not slap a mosquito. Even if I wasn't sure the deer was there, by the way, because see, the thing is, if you go slapping a mosquito while you're hunting, while you've been waiting for hours, the exact thing that you spent all that time waiting for may turn around and go the other way, and you may not ever know it was even there. Or it may be almost there, you can't quite see it. And by the way, when you're doing this particular kind of thing, you don't look around like this. Because, see, deer are really good at spotting movement, and they will not be there. You're not going to do well, right? So you have to be patient. You have to be able to sit still. And sitting still can be really hard. I have certain fidgeting characteristics. You've probably noticed them. I don't do it when I'm hunting, although the older I've gotten and the more casual I sometimes feel, and sometimes I just think, you know, I just want to sit up in this tree and not even worry about whether I get anything. I want to actually just enjoy being here. I let myself just like move a little bit, but I still do it really slow almost all the time. My dad used to bow hunt, and he would be just moving all over. And he never got a deer with a bow. So the thing is, there are things you have to endure for different purposes, and if you won't endure them, your chances of success, you could still be successful on some occasions, but it goes way down. And so anyway, the fly, the thing is, how many flies are in your life? You know, you're going to have a nice time with the Lord, right? You're going to be really close to him, you're going to snuggle up to him, he's going to snuggle up to you, you know, you're going to speak to him as a man speaks to his friend. You're going to hear his voice. He's going to hear you. You put it on your schedule. You did everything right. Everything. You planned it out perfectly. You got up early. You went to that spot. And there's a fly. And you can't kill it. And every time you're almost in that spiritual place, it comes and lands on your nose, or bumps into your eyebrow, or just goes bang against your ear, and you swat at it and you miss it and you can't stop it, and you get a swatter and you get weapons and you start trying to kill that thing, and it disappears every time you're going to do it. And then as soon as you're back in that spiritual place, it just comes and bumps on your nose again or crawls around, but by the time you can try to swat or anything, it's just gone, and it just keeps doing it. Who's in control? I want to know. The fly? You or God? Who? What? No, you can only be one place at a time. Well, I do think the flies have control. They can fly where they choose to fly. I do think that. So God's in control. If God's in control, then why is there a fly when you're trying to, especially? If God's in control, then why, right in the spiritual moment that you planned so well, that you were looking forward to so much, that you know God wants to have with you, why? Why is there a fly there right then? Well, the fact that the fly is alive probably is not the cause for it being there. Okay, let me flesh it out a little more for you. I've been in situations that match my rough description with no flies ever. No fly the whole time. Might have been something else. Might have been a fly in my head. something that constituted the effect of a fly. But I've been in those situations where there's no fly. I'm just talking about times when there are, when there is a fly. Okay, so is God in control? Is it possible God sent the fly?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. In truth, he is actually the Lord of all of the flies and all of the locusts, because we've noticed that he can send the locusts to Egypt to eat up everything, right? And then he can make them go away or blow them away with the breath of his nostril. Or scientists will explain how all of these things could have come about without there being a God. There's whole shows about it where they try to explain how every one of the miracles could have happened with no God at all. I mean, they're some of the dumbest shows I've ever seen, but they make them. Anyway, so what's happening with the fly? Why would God send a fly? I don't like that. I never have. What? What's not happy?
Not happy, Bob.
Who's Bob? Who's Bob? Okay, so anyway, I find on an occasion where if a fly can stop me, that little tiny thing. That, this, by the way, sometimes can discombobulate me, but
I killed a man with this fly.
What?
I killed a man with this fly.
Well, David killed Goliath with a little pebble. I suppose it could be done with a fly. I'm not quite following that, but it's okay. But I did lose my train of thought. God could have sent the fly, and the fly, my response to the fly, could be that whatever I had planned, or whatever I thought I had planned, or whatever I thought was supposed to happen and should have happened, which I could be completely wrong about, could be undone, apparently, from my point of view, depending on where I go with my thoughts, that the fly is the thing that stopped the plan. Now, if the fly actually stopped everything that I planned, I don't think I could say, well, God should have gotten rid of the fly. He wants me to be close to him. He wants me to spend time with him. Therefore, if I schedule it the way I'm supposed to and plan it out the way I should have, then he should make sure that a fly doesn't completely derail everything. He should have killed the fly. He should have made the fly go somewhere else. He should not have allowed the fly. Right? I could think that, though, couldn't I? I could get mad at the fly and not think about what God should have done and just be really angry at the fly and just get really, really angry. That being my spiritual response to the situation that didn't go as I willed, right? And then at that point, I might realize that I went to meet with God and he actually spoke to me. You get it? And if that's the case, what did he speak to me? He says, Lundgren, you know what? You got a problem. You want to be close to me? That's great. I like that, and I believe you do. And if you don't solve that problem, you have trouble getting close to me, because I notice right now it's keeping you, like, farther away than I am from you. So you need to solve that problem, Lundgren. And then maybe you'll get the point. And then he might say to me, as he has on some occasions, and the point was not the point that you thought was the point at all. And what I wanted wasn't what you were planning. And what I had in mind didn't have much to do with anything you were thinking. To which I say, how could that be? How could that be? So, anyway, getting back to this thing that Mike Bickle was explaining. He describes Yeshua up in glory, waiting for the marriage supper of the Lamb in a way that looks impatient. Like he's saying to the Father, he's going, please, please. Let's have a wedding. Come on, bring it. Let's do it. Let's get to the end. Let's have the ceremony. Let's have the banquet. Come on, I'm ready to go. And in some ways, the way that he said the whole thing, in some ways, I don't know if it bugged me. I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure, you know, if it matches. But the thing is, it's a useful thing to ponder. Do you think that Yeshua wants the marriage supper of the Lamb to come? So as he's wanting it, do you think he's detached from it? Do you think he forgets about his bride? No, the scriptures tell us he lives to make intercession for us, and we are his bride. He's interceding all the time for his bride, right? And apparently he's been doing it for getting to be like around 2,000 years. Is that patience or insanity? What is it? How would you describe it? What? Wait a minute. 1,000 years, that is as a day to God. If we take 1,000 of those, how many is that? You mean how many thousands of days are as years are as one day to God? If you add like 1,000,000 more of those, it's still as one day? No, I'm serious. Okay, but wait a minute. What was the question I asked just before that? Oh, did you? Oh, neither. I said something about is Yeshua patient? And did you say neither, that he's not patient or insane? Oh, he's not impatient, but I asked if he's patient. Yeah. Okay. We got there. He's patient, right? I mean, the scriptures tell us God is patient towards us, right? He's patient toward you, not willing that any should perish, but that all should be saved, right? That's not a perfect quote, but he says that. So, is it possible, I mean, how would you actually describe how do you think Yeshua feels as he's waiting? We don't think he's impatient, but he really wants it. Do you think he really wants that day to come? So it's like total serene comfort as he just patiently longs for it. I mean, how would you describe it? See, I have to think of Yeshua as being at equilibrium, right? He's not imbalanced, right? But he doesn't get balanced or able to wait by ceasing to care, right? But if he's longing, he's not getting like all wrought and fidgeting and nervous until it's going to tear him to pieces, right? I mean, how does he do this? That's Drew? What? As he sits at the right hand of God now, he's you mean touch? How do you mean? He's okay. Well, I don't think he's infirm now, but I do think he sympathizes with our infirmities, of which we have one or two. Right? Oh, okay. Good. So, all right. So, how long is it going to be until the marriage supper of the Lamb? How long is it going to be until the marriage supper of the Lamb? When the bride is ready. Is that an interval? Is that a specific amount of time?
Yeah.
Well, apparently it's one day. Even if it's 1,000 years. Or 2,000 years. And I actually think, Joanne, that if it was 2 days, the 2 days wouldn't be as 2,000 years, and vice versa. It's kind of just remains, it's all the same to God. So up to this point in the Torah this year, how are things going with God's program? Moses, look, life is hard. Has anyone noticed that? Life is hard. Sometimes it's easy. For some people it's easier at times than it is for some other people. But life itself, it's not really a simple equation, even for people that appear to have everything that you think you want. It's not necessarily at all easy for them, even if it looks like it is when you look at them. And I've known so many people known those people, and then known the people that envied them, and the people that envied them told me so and explained to me how those people had it. But I also knew what they were going through, not that I told them, but it's like, wow, I mean, the things people envy are just incredible. If only they knew that if they got what they were envying, they would be so overcome by it. If only they could understand that. And the funny thing is, even if you told them, many times they wouldn't believe it. They're just convinced that somebody else has it this certain way that's so great that they wish they had. But it's never the case, and it's never the right point of view. But so how is it going? I mean, did Moses accomplish the purpose that, what? It does seem slow. The funny thing, though, is it's very quick to God, right? See, if 1,000 years is as one day, how much? 40 years in the wilderness is how much of one day then? I think that's true, though there are whole theologies that deny that God has any feeling whatsoever, totally devoid of emotion, and that the places where the scriptures speak as though God has emotion is just worded that way so that we could somehow try to grasp it in some puny, tiny little way that really has nothing to do with what God's like. So God made man in his own image, and he gave them feelings and longings and all kinds of things, but God doesn't experience anything like that. I wonder sometimes why he would have put it into the creature he made in his own image. But we don't need to talk about that, because I think everybody here probably thinks that God's emotional state is probably not the same as yours and subject to all the slings and arrows that are inside of your emotional state, let alone things that come from the outside. But yet he has feeling, you know, he feels things. He wanted a bride that loved him. I think he actually wanted a love affair. How could you have a love affair if you can't even like notice how smitten she is with you? And how would it even work? it would become a dry philosophical thing of total detachment, but deep meaning, but totally detached. And that is the way those people describe it, basically. But even those philosophers, I think they get all wrapped up and enamored of their philosophies, even though the philosophy itself has no feeling it expresses back. So, anyway, so how is it going? Somebody said slowly. Somebody might say exactly according to plan, even though an 11-day journey seems awfully short compared to 40 years. And that's what it was, an 11-day journey from crossing a Red Sea into the Promised Land. 11 days, that's, we could say that that's how long it should have taken. That is so bitterly true. So, well, that's certainly all fits in. So just for the moment, let's go back to the Torah portion. There's this guy, Balaam, and there's this guy, Balak. Balak, Balaam, Balak, Balaam. It sounds like a car with square wheels. Or, well, two oval wheels and two square wheels. Balak, Balaam, Balak, Balaam, as it rolls around. So, anyway... So the thing is, people make their plans, right? And then people do things for certain reasons, right? So first of all, Moab looks out and they see Israel and they're afraid, right? Why are they afraid? Like an ox licks up the grass. So they're afraid that they're going to be displaced, and they're afraid that they're going to lose everything, I guess, right? And of course, from a rational human perspective, the immediate need when you have a fear is to find some way of cursing the thing you're afraid of, right? Have you ever done it? You ever hire anybody to curse the thing you're afraid of? There are people that actually hire people to curse the things they're afraid of in this country, literally. They pay somebody to curse the thing they're afraid of. There are people that pay people to stick needles in effigies of the person they're afraid of. In this country, not just somewhere out in the, somewhere else in the world. Well, hello, Tammy. Are you here alone, or are we expecting more? Okay. Well, welcome. So you know, people apparently in some ways feel the need to curse what they are afraid of. Dylan Thomas seemed to think that it was a good idea to curse death. A rage against the dying of the light, even though there's nothing you can do about it, right? That poem is a fierce description of raging against death in your powerlessness against it as the darkness comes, eternal darkness, the end of everything. But rage against it as though there was something you could do. It's like people read that as though it's some big, big, impressive accomplishment to believe that there's nothing afterwards, and to, without any hope, rage against the coming of the inevitable. To me, that is the description of what many think life is, which is a description of an absurd joke. Meaning for a while and then nothing forever. That's not meaning to me. But poets and philosophers talk about it, and they say what they will about it, and they express their feelings, which they have many. And so, at any rate, Moses was born, he lives 40 years, he ends up realizing that he's got a purpose, he tries to fulfill it, didn't go exactly the way he planned. He runs away. He's gone for 40 years. He finally gets to the point that every man has to come to where he no longer wants to fulfill the purpose of God in his own power. And at that point, he usually does not want to fulfill it at all, even with God's power. So I think that things are accelerated. This is good news. Things work faster now. People do not live usually 120 years, so it has to happen a little faster. That doesn't mean it seems any faster, right? But see, everybody wants to get what they think they should have, right? And that's in this Torah portion shows that. Moab has a problem. See, I think in God's economy, if Moab had actually said, oh, look, Israel, God's chosen. Oh, the favored of God. Hey, let's repent. Hey, let's go offer terms of peace. Hey, let's say sorry for what we did before. Let's say, you know what? We see God's going to do his will through you, and there's nothing that can stand against you. You just lick everything up, but hey, we want terms of peace. We want to know your God. We want to worship him. The thing is, if Moab had done that, do you think God would have just destroyed Moab? I don't think so. But see, when you're afraid of something, you got to do something about it, right? So in some way, frequently what we do is in some way we begin to curse the thing we're afraid of. We may not hire a soothsayer or a witch, but we might begin to curse it. We might try to deal with it according to our own thinking. Balaam wants money. Why do people want money? Why do people that have money offer money to people to come and curse? And why do people that do cursing go and curse so that they can get the money? Why do they do that? They want control. The curser wants control, and the cursee wants control. Everybody wants control, right? Money, what? Both sides want control, whatever the right word is. Balaam wants control in some way over his life. Balak wants control. He's got money. He offers money in order to get control. Balaam wants the money so that he can control something. And what does money get people? What? It gets them love, right? Money can buy you love, right? Or is it can't? Can't buy me love? Oh, can buy me. Oh, it's money can't buy me love. But people want control. What do people most immediately want? Almost all the time. What do they immediately really want? They do want control, but if they had control, what would they get with it if they could? What? Well, whatever they want, yes, but people want to be, well, they want to feel secure, right? They want comfort, right? Most people seem to want to enjoy themselves, don't they? Most people think that aren't completely enjoying themselves now tend to think that if they had more money or if they just had enough money, then they could enjoy themselves. And a rich guy in the scriptures, well, you know, the guy, the poor guy who's got wounds and a dog come and lick him and he knows he's there. The rich guy that's amassing all of his wealth, he's going, oh, I've got all this stuff now. I can lean back. I can enjoy myself. I can have a nice breakfast every morning. I can have a beautiful woman bring it to me. I can do whatever I want. I can have a nice lunch. Somebody else is going to cook it for me. I'm going to have a nice dinner. I'm going to go places. I'm going to do whatever I want in those places. And all my riches are going to make it so that I can just feel good, have comfort, do what I want, and keep that miserable, wretched, poor person away from me where I don't have to deal with stuff like that. That's basically what it amounts to, right? And that particular guy got ease here in the parable. He got ease. He enjoyed himself. He had comfort. He had physical security during his life here. And then he met his end. He hears, "You fool," after he's declared his security and confidence in himself and his plan. Tonight your soul is required of you. then the next thing we know, he's just, in the parable, he's just begging. He's just begging Lazarus, who he didn't care about, who's now in Abraham's bosom. He's looking across the chasm, and he wants a little drink. And it's like, well, sorry, we can't like traipse over there and give you a little drink. It's not possible for us to cross. It is a parable. Finally, he just begs that somebody be sent to his five brothers to tell them to never come to this wretched place. And then he's told, if they won't listen to Moses, they won't listen to somebody that comes back from the dead. Or am I mixing two things? In other words, they have all the evidence they need. God's reached out to them. They can make their choice. But some big sign sent their way right now is not going to change anything. And so having comfort or thinking you have it doesn't ensure that you'll keep it. It doesn't fulfill God's purpose. And so along the way, you think Moses suffered along the way? You think he blew it with that rock thing? He seems so patient. As far as I can tell, he was the humblest man that ever lived. I don't know that anybody's ever been called. Nobody was called in the scriptures more humble than Moses was. It says he was the meekest man on the face of the earth. It seems, I don't know. I mean, I guess I couldn't tell you whether anybody ever became meeker than that since. But he was the meekest man that ever lived. And he had a big job to do. He went incredibly slowly, at least from my perspective. It went incredibly slowly from the perspective of the million plus people that he was leading around because they complained all the time. It was slow. They didn't like it. It wasn't going the way they wanted. And so on this one occasion, he just does things a little differently than God told him to. And he doesn't say, shall God bring forth water for you out of this rock. He doesn't do it the way God tells him. And he speaks as though, and he knows differently, but he speaks as though, see, it's out of his anger. He says, you rebels. He's expressing his thoughts. He says, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock, you stinking complainers that are driving me nuts? Whack, whack, whack. And so, but water comes. What? Well, let's go easy on him. I'm not. How long before his sister died? This is the same Moses that got mad at his brother for not eating the sacrifice after his two sons got consumed by the breath of God. You know, he's like, Aaron, what are you doing? You should have eaten that. And Aaron's going, oh, will God be pleased if I ate that? Look what happened. He's like, this happened to me on the day like this. And Moses kind of goes, okay, I maybe have a point, right? So, I mean, that seems to me to probably be the meanest Moses ever was. It's probably worse than when he killed that Egyptian. But he's got passion. He's completely invested in God's plan, and he thinks that something has happened that once again puts a stumbling block in the way when Aaron didn't eat the sacrifice, right? And if you go by technical terms, it probably would have. But I've noticed that God doesn't seem to be so interested in all the technicalities, but rather the heart of the people who either keep the technicalities or miss some of them. If their heart was right. David went and ate the showbread. Nobody can do that. The scriptures don't even say God was even mildly concerned about it. In fact, Yeshua uses what David did as a defense of his own disciples, pulling heads of grain on Shabbat and popping them in their mouth, which is harvesting, which you cannot do on Shabbat. It's one of the 39 things that you cannot ever do on Shabbat and be righteous, right? There's 39 things, 39 types of work. I have a book at home, the 39 types of work that can't be done on Shabbat. It belongs to Rabbi Tammy Crystal. She left it in my care for, well, maybe in perpetuity. Anyway, it doesn't matter how many kinds of work there are. Technically, they were harvesting, and that was wrong. And Yeshua says, nope. And then he says, the priests in the temple profane the priests profane the temple every day and are held guiltless. So, anyway, I've wandered all over the place here. I'm going to read you a couple verses from Isaiah. You think God has enough time to fulfill everything that's supposed to happen? Well, he's put us in time, and he's both here with us and outside of time. So in Isaiah 63, it says, is Yeshua going to get what he really wants on time? He's going to get the wedding. He's going to get to have the banquet, the marriage supper. He's going to get to have it. Is he going to get to have it on time? Has he waited too long for it so far? Is it going to happen? Will it happen soon enough? In Isaiah 63, it says this. I'll just start at the seventh verse. I shall make mention of the loving kindness of the Lord, the praises of the Lord, according to all that the Lord has granted us, and the great goodness toward the house of Israel, which he has granted them according to his compassion, and according to the multitude of his loving kindnesses. For he said, surely they are my people, sons who will not deal falsely. So he became their Savior. In all their affliction, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his mercy, he redeemed them, and he lifted them and carried them all the days of old. But they rebelled and grieved his Holy Spirit. Therefore, he turned himself to become their enemy. He fought against them. Now, I won't keep going, but we know that where it talks about God as though he's turned against Israel, it's always about exile and return. It's about discipline and then bringing things back, right? The promise to Jacob never ends. It's never done away with. But the actions of Israel have this effect. But what I want to focus on at the moment is that God, and from Paul we learn that Messiah was with Israel all the days in the wilderness. And so it says here, he became their Savior. In all their affliction, he was afflicted. And the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his mercy, he redeemed them. So it's interesting, the notion that God is afflicted. You think God is afflicted in our affliction? You think Yeshua knows affliction and the affliction of his disciples, brothers, sisters, disciples, worshipers, servants? We're all of those things. The scriptures tell us that he sympathizes. He can sympathize with our weakness. He, in some way, he experiences what we go through. He went through everything we go through. He's interceding for us as we go through all of it. I always think that even when a person starts to doubt their own ability to pray, the Spirit groans with utterances too deep for words for us, right? And Yeshua intercedes for us. There's a weakness in us, and there's only so far we can go in whatever we have ourselves, but God gives us what we need, but yet Yeshua intercedes. And see, the thing is, I have absolute total faith in Yeshua's intercession. I don't think that God could possibly not answer him. So he's interceding for you right now, and me, and whatever I'm going through, whatever you're going through. I'm pretty sure everybody's going through something. Everybody. And there's more stuff coming to go through. And Yeshua is interceding for us all the time. And the Father listens to the prayer of Yeshua. You know, he listens to us too. But sometimes we pray for things we shouldn't even ask for. Sometimes we ask for things because of our own desire. Sometimes we want the right things, but we want them the wrong way. But all the while, Yeshua is interceding. And part of his intercession, I imagine, is, Father, just help them. Help them understand. It'll be easier for them when they understand. Please help them. It's like, really, come on. Let's help him. Let's help Lundgren. Let's just show him a little another piece. Does he have to suffer so much for so long? Yeshua's pleadings with his Father are going to be answered. He's pleading about things with respect to you right now, I believe. The Father is going to answer him. He's going to do his will. He is working in you for his own good pleasure. And even when you look in the mirror and say, I don't see any pleasure he could be getting, I don't know if I'm sorry or not, but it's going to happen. I'm sorry, you don't see what God sees when he looks at you. You don't see what he's already done in you clearly, and you don't understand how precious you were that he came for you. And perhaps you're judging the progress and the condition of things based on whether certain things seem to have gone the way you think they should have, but it's progressing according to God's plan. And I think the Lord wants all of you to know that you should not get discouraged, though he understands that all of us do and can. He understands the temptation. He understands how painful some things are. He knows how tired we get. And he's bigger than all of that. He carries us through some things when we don't even realize he's carrying us. And in the psalm Judah read, one of the lines is, at your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. The scriptures say that by one sacrifice Yeshua perfected for all time those who are redeemed by his sacrifice, right? There's a sense in which the perfection, it's already ours. And when I read that line, at his right hand there are pleasures forevermore, I think it's very easy to just read it one day. From that day on, there will be pleasures forevermore at his right hand. But see, I think the right way to read it is, there are pleasures at his right hand forevermore. And forever, I think, must include the time in which I am now living. Yes, when the fullness of the kingdom comes, it will be different. In the age to come, things will be different than they are now. But there are pleasures at God's right hand now. And he sets a table before us in the midst of things that we could fret about and become wrought about and forget that he set the table. But if we'll sit down at the table and trust him, then all the things that we're afraid of, that we might want to curse, that we're wrought about, will grow strangely dim, and we can just sup with him, because the scripture says, you open a door to him, he'll come in and sup with you. Doesn't say in the age to come, when you open the door. And if we've done that, then that is the place we live in. We just need to learn that the flies don't have the power to rob us of that. We have to hand it to them. So, Lord, I ask you to be tender with us all today. Touch us, speak to us, take us up in your arms. Put a little oil on our scabs that are pulling hard on our skin, irritating us. Help us, Lord, to just receive from your hand your love and tenderness, that we could just come to rest in you and receive mercy, grace, to help in time of need, as we come without shame or fear before your throne, because Yeshua has given us the right to do so by washing us in his blood and raising us up to new life with him. We claim that. We thank you for it. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmarecha. Ya'er Adonai panavelecha v'echunecha. Yisa Adonai panavelecha v'yasem lecha. Shalom.